when you put someone in a cage and take their freedom away in any context, but particularly in the context when they're innocent, it's dehumanizing and demoralizing on so many levels. Uno, dos,
tres. Hey, welcome to In the Thick. It's a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Today we have a very special guest. Joining us from Yonkers, New York, is Jamal Bowman.
Nice.
He's the 2020 Democratic nominee for Congress in New York's 16th District. Jamal, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Jamal, you know, we don't often speak to, you know, members of Congress or potential members of Congress. There have been a few, like somebody maybe Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, yeah. You know, because your win, like hers, was a really big deal. You defeated longtime Democratic incumbent Elliot Engel in a huge landslide lead. You're the likely winner in the 2020 general election because you represent a very blue district. So it's really been a super big year for you. Your primary win came at the height of the conversation around justice for Black and brown lives, inequity, the pandemic. You know, we're feeling it. So really, your win came kind of on the backs of all of that. So give us just the quick backstory.
Sure. So the backstory, I guess, begins, you know, being raised by a single mom in the projects, along with my three sisters, during the crack cocaine epidemic.
Which projects? I got to know. Which projects?
Oh, East River Projects, okay. On 105th and First Avenue in Manhattan.
Yep.
Yeah,
so I'm born and raised on the Upper East Side, East Harlem section of Manhattan. Went to public schools my entire life, lived in the projects and rent-stabilized apartments. Started teaching in 1999 in the South Bronx in one of the poorest zip codes in the country. And you clearly can see the inequality, the inequity, and how wherever you go in a city, state, or country, Black and brown people seem to be suffering more than everyone else. So growing up as a Black man in America, who has been a victim of police brutality. The first time I was beaten by police, I was 11 years old.
Wow.
And notice I said the first time because it happened again later on in my life.
11?
Yeah, I was 11, hanging out in the street, you know, with my friends, you know, being rambunctious and boisterous and doing what all kids do. And I guess someone may have called the police because we were maybe too noisy or too rambunctious, I guess. And the police came over and tried to like sort of curtail us and tell us to calm it down. And you know, we kind of pushed back and had a few words for them. Next thing I know, like I'm being thrown up against the wall, thrown to the ground, face dragged all over the floor, nightstick in the back, you know, et cetera. And then we're taken to the precinct. And I spoke to my mom about this later. We're taken to the precinct and they call my mom to come pick me up with a birth certificate because they didn't believe I was 11.
Damn.
Wow.
And, you know, it makes me think of Tamir Rice as I say that out loud. Right.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
So she comes with the birth certificate, picks me up and takes me home.
Yeah.
They didn't explain to her what the charges were, if any, why they approached us to begin with. They just allow her to take me home. And my mom and I didn't even think to, you know, press charges or file a report or anything like that. We just kept it moving. And it just tells you how internalized sort of our oppression is, right? Like we just accept, we have accepted, and I have accepted that, okay, there's nothing we can do. We're powerless. So becoming a teacher and being a social justice advocate within education and having the opportunity to be a founding principal of my own district public school, not a charter school, and being an education organizer around equity and restorative justice and culturally responsive schools, all of that led to me, you know, thinking about a potential run for office and why Elliot Engel. Well, I looked at the 2018 election and I saw that only 30,000 registered Democrats in the district actually voted.
Damn.
And he won with 22,000 votes.
Yeah.
So I'm like, wow, this person is making $1 trillion decisions that impact millions of people.
Wow.
And he only got 22,000 votes.
Yep.
And then when you look at who supports him, right, who funds his campaign, we're talking big real estate, big pharmaceutical companies, weapons manufacturers, hedge fund managers, and every institution that is hurting our community and hurting the working class, those are the people and institutions that funded his campaign. So that's why we decided to challenge him and ultimately we're able to win in the end.
Damn, that connection.
So speaking about connections, I have to make a reveal, Jamal.
A reveal.
Okay.
I might blow your mind.
in a second because people don't realize that I'm half Italian. My mom is Bronx Italian.
Uh-oh.
And my grandfather is Mario Biaggi.
Wow.
Who Elliot Engel beat 30 years ago. You know, just look up the history. And so you won my grandfather's district 30 years later. And I actually grew up on Marshall Loop Parkway after moving from Puerto Rico, right in, you know, at the edge of the North Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a part of me, what you're talking about, the district, how much it's changed, right? In a lot of ways, because I remember growing up in Marshall Loop Parkway. I remember, you know, Jerome Avenue, other places. And to see you actually represent a district that has changed a lot.
That was before represented by an Italian, you know, New Yorker named Mario Biaggi. I mean,
yeah, right.
It's a different mm-hmm. district.
And so I just needed to say that because that's our connection. I had to be upfront. So, so there you go. You beat Engel. And I will say one thing.
that laugh.
Yeah. My mom texted me after you won and she's like, Engel lost. Like it was a little bit of a family thing, but so anyway.
So she wasn't excited. She wasn't.
No,
happy
she was happy.
Won.
I'm just saying she was happy, Jamal. That you know, you bring back you know 30 years of history. But anyway, in a lot of ways, your victory was also fueled by the moment for Black Lives that we are living and breathing every day. The primary happened right in June, right? As daily protests were ongoing in New York City, but you've actually been outspoken, like you said, against police brutality as a Black mm-hmm. educator in New York for such a long time. I also want to call out the opinion piece that you wrote in March for NBC Think in response to Mike Bloomberg's presidential campaign. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Remember that, guys, when he ran, like pre-pandemic, yeah. when you detailed your own experiences with the NYPD under Bloomberg's time. So not only when you were 11, when you were talking about stop and frisk was rampant during that time.
Yes.
And in that piece, you write about one incident where you were pulled over for failing to signal and then you were arrested, at saying that mm-hmm. you were, quote, taken to the local police precinct and put in a cage not much bigger than a bathroom with two other people, one bench and one toilet. While one person gets to occupy the bench, the other two are forced onto the filthy floor. When you are locked in a cage, you are suddenly no longer human. You're an animal. Your spirit shifts into survival mode.
Right. And what you write there, this has to be said, Maria, mm-hmm. that phrase
powerful
relates so much to what's happening in current immigration detention facilities. When you wrote that, Jamal, I was like, wait a mm-hmm. minute, is he talking about NYPD or is he talking about Black and brown bodies on the border? So this is all intersectional. Mm-hmm. And especially after George Floyd's murder and all the lost Black lives that have come up in our consciousness since George Floyd, this conversation around policing, right, has evolved more around defunding the police and dismantling the prison industrial complex, ideas that were never mainstream before. So talk to me more about that and how do you see these issues impacting the 2020 election?
You know, it's crazy. As you read the quote from the op-ed, I literally went back to that prison cell yeah. psychologically as you wow. read the quote. And I got emotional wow. and overwhelmed listening to you read it because I remember that experience. And, you know, many people may not put that under the category of police brutality, but it is because I shouldn't have been arrested. I was released without seeing a judge. And when you put someone in a cage and take their freedom away in any context, but particularly in a context when they're innocent, it's dehumanizing and demoralizing on so many levels. And, you know, you mentioned what's happening at the border. You know, mass incarceration and mass deportation is one and the same.
Mm.
And when we have a white nationalist in the White House, the targets are going to be people with brown skin, whether it's light brown or dark brown, whether it's the Muslim ban separating families from each other at the border and caging children, or police brutality and mass incarceration in Black and brown communities of those who are quote-unquote citizens, it's all one and the same. It's all a suppression and oppression and a 21st century enslavement of Black and brown bodies, whether it's physical or psychological. And that's the long-term impact here. It's the psychological right. impact on people who are brown and Black, and what we internalize as a result of white nationalism or white supremacy. What's happened over the course of my life and what I've experienced personally and with my students is this internalization of our inferiority as Black and brown people. And that's what we're fighting against as much as anything else. We are not inferior. We are equal to and or superior to anyone who tries to dehumanize us and oppress us and make us feel less than our brilliant human selves. And it's something that, you know, I want to capture for white America as well, because white people who've internalized this idea of white superiority, whether consciously or unconsciously, are doing a disservice to themselves and their children as well.
Preach, preach.
Because you are much more than your whiteness. You are human. And as a human, you have a responsibility to other humans, and you have the capability to do remarkable things other than to just spend your time hating other people. I mean, hate is exhausting. I don't got no time to hate nobody. I'm trying to live in love, man, and uplift other people. Who got
time
for hate?
It's like Radio Raheem and Do the Right Thing, that when you're talking about it, love beating hate. Yeah.
One hand is always fighting the other hand, and the left hand is kicking much ass. I mean, it looks like the right hand love is finished. But hold on, stop the presses. The right hand's coming back. Yeah, he got the left hand on the ropes now. That's right. Yeah. Ooh, it's a devastating right hand. Hate is hurt. He's down. Ooh. Ooh, left hand. Hate KO'd by love.
Here it is, love and hate.
Yeah, but I agree with you so much, Jamal, in the sense that, and it's weird because I'm like, preach, preach. I don't usually talk this way to a politician, but you're not yet in Congress, so I can do that. But I'm with you. I think for me, one of the difficult moments, right, is that we internalize this trauma and it suppresses us and our hope and our possibility, which is why I'm so enthusiastic about the fact that you decided to run, because it's, you know, it's a bit of a challenge. So we're very happy about the fact that, you know, because we celebrate democracy on this show. We just get out there, do it. And yours was one of really, I mean, it's pretty cool. It was a historic progressive win in the Democratic Party this year. We talked on the show about Cori Bush's historic win in Missouri. She will become Missouri's first Black woman in Congress if she wins in November. Mm-hmm. And there have been a lot of other progressive wins across the country, local, statewide, like Senator Ed Markey's win in Massachusetts in early September. And it's really fueling the conversation about the future of what the Democratic Party looks like, which I know you, Jamal, like us, we think about all the goddamn time. It's just like, well, so, you know, progressive policies like Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, they are becoming more normalized.
Yes.
New York has also seen its share of progressive wins. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won in 2018 and then just now again. Jamal, you talk a lot about what you'll do when you get to Congress. And you will be, in fact, one of the more radical peeps among your peers. And I actually think it's really so important that you're talking about, like, getting arrested at 11, being beaten. Like, people need to hear this from a future member of Congress. You will be seen as an addition to the squad, the testosterone addition to the squad. So if Joe Biden wins in November, for the next 4 years, the Democratic Party is going to be led by somebody who is very clearly defining himself as a moderate.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the future of progressivism within the Democratic Party. And what's the plan? What's the plan for you and for that side of the party?
Well, I think part of the plan is shifting the conversation from, in terms of redefining what we mean by radical. I think it's radical when you have over 185,000 people dying from a global pandemic, the coronavirus, while the millionaire and billionaire class has grown, and Jeff Bezos is now the first 200 billionaire in the country. That's radical from the perspective of how wealth is concentrated in this country, how the top 400 earners in this country, because most of their wealth comes from capital gains, don't really pay any federal tax at all. How Amazon and other large corporations do not pay federal tax, and they hide their money in offshore accounts. They hide billions of dollars in offshore accounts. That's radical. It's radical where we're able to give, you know, trillion-dollar tax breaks to Wall Street, but we're not able to house the homeless and feed the poor and provide a federal jobs guarantee. So we need to redefine what we mean by radical. Mm-hmm. The wealthy elite and those who have been in Congress for 10, 20, 30 years supporting the wealthy elite and supporting corporate America in its oppression of working class people, they are the radical ones. What myself and Cori Bush and AOC and Ayanna and Rashida and Ilhan are speaking is common sense, which is why the majority of people in this district and across the country support Medicare for All, support a Green New Deal, support housing as a human right, support fully funding our public schools and environmental justice. So the future of the Democratic Party lives in the present in terms of the healthy tension that we need to have to push the party more in the direction of common sense. So I'm going to do everything I can to make sure Joe Biden wins. And then I will fight with Joe Biden every single day I am in Congress to make sure we provide a federal jobs guarantee. We raise the federal minimum wage. We invest in minority women and Black-owned businesses and do everything we can to reverse the impact of economic and racial oppression that's been in place since the beginning of this country.
Okay.
The Democratic Party has to fight each other to strengthen itself, to grow our base, so that we can make sure that we never get another Republican president like Donald Trump again.
I mean, you know, you could say that the Republican Party could have fought for its party, and it didn't. It let Donald Trump come in and just completely become the party. So what you're saying is that this is what democracy looks like. It looks like a battle. We are talking about ideas. By the way, Jamal, you don't know this, but my book, Once I Was You, is out now. Okay. But I write a whole thing about when I get to New York and I'm like, why do people want to call me a radical? What is the definition of radical? And radical, the definition is you go to the root.
Yeah.
And so you're saying the root is look at this injustice.
That's right.
That's what you're saying. That's what's the radical root is that look at this injustice here.
You mentioned the presidential election. So let's talk about it. You know, it's coming up on November 3rd. Not to overgeneralize what Joe Biden is running his campaign on or his platform, but a main message of it, a key message is basically, I'm not Trump. Mm-hmm. And this push by Democrats that you talk about for unity between progressives and more establishment Democrats in order to get Trump out, I think it's a little bit like 2016, but I feel at the same time there might be some more purpose, but I'm not sure yet. And, you know, we won't know. But for the folks who've been marching on the streets for, you know, for people of color, for the indigenous community, for LGBTQ communities, this election's really literally life or death, and it's different by every measure.
And, you know, I mean, right now we're in the middle of this global pandemic, so voting is going to be mostly by mail. Although I've made a decision I'm going to do in person. I'm going to just go out there at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Good for you.
And wait. Not to mention, like daily, the fact that Trump is using the pandemic to continue to undermine mail-in voting. Look, we all see that this president is interfering with the election, trying to destabilize at every possible moment. We're in this economic recession, you know, millions filing for unemployment. And the country, we've been watching this moment, living through it, the demand for racial justice since the murder of George Floyd in May. Plus, of course, the continued violence against Black women, trans Black women of color. And, you know, the thing about Biden is that he's also opposed the calls for defunding the police. So you have just told us, Jamal, and I love it. You just said, I'm going to do everything every day that I can to make sure that Joe Biden gets elected. And then when he's in office, I'm going to hold him accountable. So how are you going to hold him accountable?
So on the issue of police reform, that may be the biggest fight. Even though Democrats in the House have already passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, so that's there. And it's something that, you know, has pretty good teeth when you talk about qualified immunity and you look at certain other areas. Qualified immunity is a big one, right? When police commit a crime, they need to be held accountable. Right now, there's no federal policy that supports that. So the House is already there. If we can flip the Senate and get the Senate on the same page with the Justice and Policing Act, then it'll force Biden's hand to support that or make changes as he see fit. And then it will be on him in terms of what those changes will be. But clearly, at a state level, city level, and federal level, people are demanding police reform, quote unquote. And I use that word in quotes just because reform has always been very soft, you know, historically. So that's going to be a fight. I want to commend Joe Biden's position on universal child care and early childhood education. He is in a place where me as a former educator, I'm happy he's speaking that language because child care, man, is like a rent payment. Yeah. I mean, people are already struggling and they can barely afford child care. And, you know, so I'm glad he's tackling that. And I'm glad he's tackling environmental justice, which is a huge, huge issue. If we don't get this thing turned around, you know, we're not going to be prepared for what climate change is going to bring to more of us, and it's already impacting millions of us all over the world. But the issue of police reform, you're right, is going to be a fight. And, you know, it's not just, it's the defunding that's part of it, but the reallocating of resources toward a new conversation around public safety and public health. And, you know, in early September, Elizabeth Warren, Ayanna Presley, and Barbara Lee introduced policy that looks at racism as a public health crisis. And that's where we have to move Joe Biden and others so that they understand that, look, it's not just police reform, it's institutional racism. It lives in every fabric of American life. And if we take a public health approach, then we can look differently at policing in our communities. And the last thing I will say is this, you know, and I tweeted this the other day, police have never made me feel safe. Mm. I don't feel safe because of police. I feel safe because of my family, my home, having food on the table, having a job with health insurance and dignity, and living amongst good people who are well-educated and seeking more education and connection. That is what keeps us safe, not more police in the street. And I'm sorry, the last thing I want to say is
this. Keep going.
Dutch, we're interviewing you, sweetie. This is not a 30-second soundbite show. Go.
It's just, you know, historically, again, there's been the racial oppression explicitly and implicitly, and that has lived in our economy in terms of job training programs, economic opportunities, and job availability. And instead of bringing more jobs, we bring more police. If the jobs aren't there, people are going to do what they got to do to survive. And I don't condone crime or violence, but when you create communities of concentrated trauma,
right,
violence is going to happen. And you respond to that not with police.
Exacto.
You respond with jobs and healthcare and housing and dignity.
Exactly.
And our country has failed to do that. And Joe Biden has an opportunity in this moment to do that. Mm.
All right. Hope you're listening, Joe.
They follow us. Don't worry. So what you bring up, Jamal, is really gets to the essence of what the Democratic base really is in 2020, right? Like, what is the Democratic Party? What is the soul of the Democratic Party? Is it changing? And just looking at this past August, you know, during the Democratic National Convention, it still featured longtime establishment Democratic speakers, as well as some Republicans. And like Maria and I have said in the past, there were only three Latinos and Latinas who were invited to speak at the DNC during prime time. Because in the end, this is all about prime time. You know, it's the main stage, you know, the 9 to 11 slot. You know, that's the big marquee. It's not 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Twitter stream. And also in terms of the presidential and vice presidential debates, none of the moderators are Latino. Meanwhile, polls have shown that Biden still has work to do with younger voters. And I've actually written about that for The Atlantic about younger Latino voters, where I'm like, let's go. He has less support. And he has less support, according to some polls, from Black voters than Hillary Clinton did in 2016. So there's this fear that the enthusiasm just isn't there for key core constituencies of the Democratic Party
that you need in order to win big.
That you need to win. And especially the district you'll be representing, a district that has a significant Black and Latino population, 32% Black and 27% Latino, according to the census. So, Jamal, are Democrats doing a good enough job right now empowering these voters? And how do you plan to support your own Black and Latino constituents when you're in Congress?
No.
Oh, the short answer.
Absolutely not.
He was like, let me just take.
We are not doing a good enough job of engaging young people people of color overall. We are not. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, go to the hood.
Yeah.
Spend weeks in the hood in every city in this country.
That's all.
To get young people and people of color fired up about your campaign. Yeah. Democratic Party, what are you doing? You put AOC on for 60 seconds?
It was more like, okay, it was more like 80 seconds.
Oh, I mean, she is brilliant. She is fearless. She is great at communicating a vision to a diverse group of people. She gets people excited. And you give her 80 seconds? But you give John Kerry? Even Bill Clinton? No disrespect to Bill Clinton, man. But young kids from the hood don't want to hear from Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
They want to hear from AOC.
Right.
They want to hear from Ayanna Presley. They want to hear from Cori Bush. They want to hear from others. And the Democrats, they continue to miss the boat here because they continue to target the independent and or on the fence, quote unquote, moderate voter. And they want that voter to come Democrat and not Republican. And I get it. But we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to grow our base.
Yes.
We have to grow our base. We tripled voter turnout in this election in this district. Why? Because the first week we were able to canvass, which is the week after we announced, we were in Eden Wall Projects knocking on doors.
Yep.
And we were there again and again and again because it wasn't just about a vote. It was about engaging them in the democratic process.
In the process, right.
Yeah. It was about having their voice centered in the process. And it wasn't just for show, and it was authentic. And that's why we tripled turnout. And we won parts of the district where people thought we had no shot in winning because that was the establishment's community. Well, guess what? The establishment has failed to connect with young people and people of color.
Right.
That's why the Justice Democrats needed to come into existence. They filled a void. That's why the Sunrise Movement needed to come into existence. They filled a void. That's why your show exists. It's filling a void.
Yep.
People of color have a lot to say.
Yes.
And a lot of great ideas.
Yes.
Especially young people.
Yep.
And we aren't doing nearly enough to grow the base. And as you were loading up the question, I just felt myself exasperated.
I'm loading it up like one of those baseball machines, those hitting machines. I'm like, let me fill it up with some balls. Go, Jamal, go.
You know, it's just like, you know, it's so polished, right? The DNC was so polished, so well put together.
Yeah.
You make sure you had just enough brown, just enough young, just
right.
enough old.
That's what
in
I said,
your
yeah.
little commercials. But like, dog. You gotta give AOC 5 to 10 minutes and then bring in others. Grow your base because it's not just about beating Trump. We have to win in a landslide. We have to make a statement in terms of beating Trump and flipping the Senate. So far, we've missed these opportunities, and the data that you have is clear evidence of that. You know, there's no slam dunk.
Yeah.
We might lose this election. We better do something about it over the next days.
I'm just wondering, Jamal, you know, I love the fact that you said that you will work every day to elect Joe Biden and then every day challenge him. So are you feeling like is the process to go back into the projects and to be knocking on doors and saying, we're here and we're talking to you about going to vote for Biden? Like, is that what it looks like? And is your squad that did that for you in the projects way back when, are they going to do that now?
So yes and yes. So, you know, we're doing a lot of work around the census in our district, which is extremely important. You know, folks from the hood don't fill out the census till the last minute, if at all. So we got to get those numbers up to make sure that, you know, we get the resources into our community that we need. So that's essential. And then, yes, you know, we're in New York. So, you know, Biden's going to win New York, right? Mm-hmm. And he should do well in New York. What I've been doing and what our team's been doing is we're beginning to have conversations with people in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh.
I was going to say, you're going to Pennsylvania.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Milwaukee. Mm. you know, in different areas of the country. And we're trying to organize and build a base around that with the Working Families Party and their new director, Maurice Mitchell, who's phenomenal, with the Black Male Voter Project and Mondale Cobb Robinson, who's phenomenal, really targeting the communities that are historically ignored. That's what we're doing with or without the Biden campaign, because we have to grow the base and we have to build Democratic strength across the country to win and win big, so that when we go forward, we could pass bold, radical policy that gets to the core of the issues.
I think what you're saying, Jamal, is you win with, you know, like the sports analogy, you don't win by playing defense.
Correct.
You win by taking it to the hoop. You know what I'm saying? Like taking it to the hole.
Even I understood that.
But and you don't win by chilling.
Exactly.
Right? And that's the other thing. Like you said this feels like 2016. I woke up about a week ago on a Saturday in like a cold sweat. Like I woke up in a panic. Yeah. Like, yo, it feels like we're chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we cannot be chilling right now.
I'm with you.
And Trump and the Republicans, let me tell you what they have. They have unity around a message, and they are wrong and strong, which means they are loud as hell.
Damn.
They are totally wrong, but they are loud as hell.
Yeah.
And their base is going to get behind that.
Yeah.
And we need to be loud too. And the other thing the Republican Party did, they spoke to where the energy is in the Democratic Party. They continue to talk about radical left extremists.
Yeah.
They continue to talk about socialism. They continue to talk about defunding the police and cancel culture. Guess who they're speaking to? They're speaking to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. They're speaking to the left. They're speaking to us because they know that's where the energy is. How do they know that? But Biden doesn't know that.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to our final segment, which we call COVID coping.
So we want to know, Jamal, what you doing in order to, I mean, we talked about waking up in a cold sweat and being worried and being scared and being active and being angry and, you know, turning that into action. But, you know, what are you doing to find joy? What are you doing to find hope? Maybe you do that and find it when you're out in the projects knocking on doors. But what is the thing that in this moment of COVID and so many other challenges, what are you doing to find a sense of hope?
You know, so yes, definitely. Whenever we're able to get out there, mask on, socially distance and connect with people, that's always uplifting and inspiring. That's number one. Number two, I mean, I'm the luckiest dude in the world. I have an amazing wife, amazing kids, an amazing family. Mm. And the center of all that is my 6-year-old daughter, Maya. So, you know, when you have a daughter, when you're a father and you have a daughter, it's like, you know,
I'm with you.
This is the center of my universe right here.
I'm with you.
She is my joy and hope and everything in between. So that's a beautiful thing. And yeah, I mean, I also like doing this kind of work, like talking to you all and continuing to engage politically and just doing the job is inspiring and hopeful and uplifting. I feel very fortunate to be in this position in this moment. I mean, we're dealing with the Spanish flu, the Great Depression, the civil rights movement, and economic catastrophe all at the same time. You know, and I've been fortunate enough to win a big election and be on my way to Congress in this moment. So there's just so much work to do. To your point, it does get exhausting. I mean, you know, just the other day, there was another brother shot by a cop. You know, apparently he had a gun, whatever the case may be. But once again, you know, Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor. I mean, it's just, it does get exhausting and overwhelming just being Black or brown in this country. But yeah, my family is my core and my center, and connecting with people and just seeing how excited people are, you know, about our win. It's like, it's really a feeling like we all won. Like I didn't just win, we all won. Mm. And people are really fired up about that.
Well, congratulations, Jamal. Congratulations. From understanding that even though you were beat up by cops when you were 11, that didn't mean that you were going to internalize disempowerment. And in fact, what you did was, I'm all about owning this power. So congratulations for that. And congratulations for becoming the presumptive Democratic nominee for Congress in New York's 16th district. And thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick. We really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
And dear listener, remember, you got to go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us if you haven't done so already. Really helps. Also, remember, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you choose to get your podcast. Also, check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook. Tell your friends and family. That's really important to do. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Harsha Nahata, with editorial support from Erica Dilday. Our audio engineers are Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our intern is Sophie Davis. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain ZZK Records. Dear listener, hasta la próxima. Until the next episode, goodbye.
Democracy lives. Love it. Bye, guys.
Que viva democracia. Que viva la democracia. I mean, one of the squad members did say, fuck that. I'm just saying. So, you know.
Let me guess. That was Rashida, wasn't it? That was Rashida Tlaib. Am I right about that?
You are right about that. You are right about that.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.